the input on the 146.25, the normal input, is not yet operational, and Eric is working on that. So that's maybe why we're not hearing from Howard at this time. And 2YYZ, if you're there, K2RIW, the TechNet. Okay, I did hear K2UPS has a comment by way of the input. I heard John tell me that K2UPS has got a comment. Right now, the ordinary 146.25 input is not yet operational. If you do have a way of getting through to us by way of the 375 channel, let's see if Rich can do that. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, mobile, K2RIW on the TechNet. You've got it, Rich.
Okay, good evening, Dick. K2UPS mobile, coming in via Echolink. My comment was for the station flooding with Steve, which is the SWR going up with the hardline and the LMR 400. I'm not really familiar with hardline much, but I'm just curious, being that the hardline has less loss, and particularly since he's using less of it, maybe there was a situation that was being masked with attenuation through the LMR 400 that has now come up, because he has less attenuation. And something that I had thought of, and I don't know if you wanted to comment on that. Back to you.
Yeah, very fine, Rich. That is a good comment. Because what you measure in the shack, you call it the standing wave ratio, really is reflected power ratio, reflected voltage ratio, call it what you like. Because the signal going up to the antenna is going through your whole cable system once on the way up, and then because the antenna is less than a perfect 50 ohm resistive load, if it's higher or lower resistance, or if it's got any amount of capacitance or inductance to it, a calculatable, quantifiable amount of signal is going to come back down. That signal coming back down is traveling through your transmission line system for a second time, and therefore, if the transmission line system has a significant insertion loss, that signal going through the system, insertion loss twice, can come back with a fairly weak signal reflected. Therefore, you get a fairly low indicated standing wave ratio in the shack. And what Rich is bringing to our attention is that if, for instance, the standing wave ratio was coming from the antenna is let's assume it's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And if my feed line has a whole lot of loss to it, in the shack I'll measure 1.2, even though the real antenna is 2-to-1, because that signal going through it twice is being attenuated that much. And now if I replace that cable system with one with a hell of a lot lower loss, I'll suddenly start seeing the real 2-to-1 that was always there. So that's a very good point that Rich is bringing up. You can get a phony improvement, apparent improvement of standing wave ratio by doing nothing but putting a 10 dB pad anywhere along the transmission line. You open up the transmission line anywhere from beginning, middle, or end, and add a 10 dB attenuator, and all of a sudden, your reflected power ratio will get 20 decibels lower, because the 10 dB attenuator is attenuating the signal going forward and attenuating the signal coming back by 10 dB, so that if your reflected power ratio used to be 9 dB, which, by the way, is the number you would get with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, the reflected signal will be 9 dB weaker, and you add a 10 dB pad, and it's going to add 20 dB to the system. Your reflected signal was that used to be 9 dB reflected, minus 9 dB, is now going to be minus 29 dB, which is equivalent to about a 1.05 standing wave ratio. So by adding a 10 dB pad, a real 2-to-1 standing wave ratio will look something a hell of a lot lower. So if you can do it with an attenuator, a fixed attenuator, bear in mind that a distributed attenuator called lossy transmission line is giving you the same effect. And that's what Rich is bringing to our attention. Let me do a check here and see if we're back on the air with 146.25. Stand by. Yeah, and the answer is no. The 146.25 input is not yet operational. Let me see if I have the PL tone turned on. I had the PL tone turned on, so that wasn't it. So right now, anybody who wants to talk to us has got to do it by way of the 147.375 Eastern repeater. because the Western repeater input right now, I think, is not functioning. Do I have that correct, Eric? KE2EJ, if you want to make a comment. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, that's the status where we are. Don't know if we're going to be able to pick up Howard. Howard being in Belmore, that's a long path for him to get to the Selden repeater. Okay, let's try going over to the mailbag. Do you, John, have the ability to go into the western input? I mean, Gretchen, the eastern input. Because right now the western input is not operational. KC2WGB with that question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
375 Magic, how copy?
I'm hearing you. 15% noise, 85% audio. Good sounding signal. Just a little bit of noise in the background, but we're hearing you on the eastern input, John. And I'm going to have to go over to your house and install a high gain Yagi on 2 meters that's aimed at the eastern input from your QTH. I'll admit it's a long haul from Staten Island where you live all the way out there to Selden, Long Island, which I'm guessing is a healthy 55 miles or so. KC2WGB with the mailbag. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, how are we coming on the eastern machine?
I guess that was Lou, I'm not sure. On the eastern machine, you're coming in very well.
Thank you very much.
I guess that the voice I heard was Lou, is that correct?
Yes, indeed, yes, indeed.
I'm also coming in on the eastern machine because the 146.25 input on the 8.5 machine right now is not operational, and I think Eric is in the process of fixing that. KC2WGB with the mailbag. I'll answer any question except ones with standing with time domain reflectometry. I'm having some fun with John. I happen to know what's coming. You got it, John. K2RIW.
Elevate your power a little bit, Dick. Is this any better?
It's still a little bit noisy, but sounds quite good, so please proceed.
Okay, got a couple of good ones tonight. This specific one that we spoke about is an amateur who has been playing with a TDR machine that he acquired. And he has a question. He has about 30 meters of coax that he's been testing, and the meter reads it fine, which isn't the correct distance. He put another meter length added to it with a tape. And you can see the little bump in the display where the T is located exactly on the mark. What he wonders is, now when he puts an additional length of coax on there, like a stud joint, he's not seeing an additional length to the length of the coax itself. It still reads very close to 30 meters. Is that correct? And why is that? Back to you, Dave. Maybe tell us now. If you do, what would you do?
Very fine. Now, Erickson. John's signal was a little bit noisy, so I'll repeat the question for anyone who had trouble hearing it. The mailbag person was saying that he's using a time domain reflectometer. He's going through a transmission line system that has a T connector in it, and then when you put a piece of coax cable off to one side of the T connector, the time domain reflectometer will show you a significant perturbation. In other words, you'll get a bump in the display on the oscilloscope of the time domain reflectometer. I'm going to start calling it a TDR. You'll get a bump on that display because there really is your straight through cable going through the T connector and the cable coming off to the one side. So as far as the T connector is concerned, you've got a pair of 50 ohm transmission lines in parallel inside of that T connector. So that signal going down the cable for a short period of time, it says, I'm seeing 25 ohms. And therefore, I'm going to give you a great big bump on the TDR display. That's the way it should be. Now, I'm telling people that you can use this T connector with a cable going off to one side. And if that cable is of reasonable length, it's a lanyard going to your handy-talkie, for instance, and you've done my suggestion of installing a yucky old antenna on the chimney of the house, but because it's up high, a simple coat hanger antenna, so to speak, made out of very inexpensive materials, with the cable coming down into the house and the cable wanders through your bedroom, your living room, your dining room, your kitchen, and your basement. And each one of those places, you got a T connector where you can tap into it. And so when you tap into it, how well will the system work? Let me drop it. You could be led to believe from the TDR that it's going to be terrible. In reality, you actually do it, and 98% of the time, it's going to work like a charm. If you want to be a purist, where you tap into the T connector, you could open up the connector for the rest of the cable going downrange into the house. And so now your T connector is a simple right angle adapter, so to speak. And a T connector is a right angle adapter all the way up to at least 1 gigahertz. It will work like a charm. You won't even know it's there. And if you measure the T connector as a right angle adapter on the TDR, you're going to see a very small perturbation. However, in the way we're describing it, with the T connector having all three connections being used, you're going to first think that from the TDR that, gee, that's a terrible thing to do. Okay. If that cable, the actual stub coming off to one side of the T connector, happened to be a stub that you're using for frequency tuning, where you've made it a quarter length long into a short circuit. A quarter wavelength long into a short circuit. Every piece of quarter wave transmission line is an impedance. It's an impedance inverter. That's a fancy way of saying that a short circuit at one end becomes an open circuit at the other end at that frequency where it's a quarter wavelength long. So a stub a quarter wavelength long into a short circuit becomes an open circuit at the T connector, and it's not there. At that frequency, it's literally not there. Only at that frequency, or at every odd harmonic of that frequency. The stub can be a quarter wavelength long, three quarters of a wavelength long, five quarters of a wavelength long, and again, a short circuit will be an open circuit. Or conversely, if you make the stub a half wavelength long into an open circuit, half wavelength repeats impedance, again at that frequency. Half wavelength long and multiples of that will give you an open circuit at the T connector. Again, that can be used as a frequency selective device to pass your favorite frequency and reject all others. Let me drop. However, your T connector, your TDR, your time domain reflectometer, what it does is to put an extremely brief pulse down the system and down the transmission line. It's really a kind of a radar inside of your coax cable. That's what a TDR really is. It's inside a coax cable radar. Sends a very brief pulse down the line, and if there's anything other than 50 ohm transmission line on every one of the components it goes through, it's going to give you some reflected signal that'll appear as a bump on the cathode ray tube of that time domain reflectometer. Very brief pulse represents all possible frequencies. If that very brief pulse out of your TDR happened to have a rise time of 1 nanosecond, and a good one does that, if not even a little bit better, 1 nanosecond rise time, 1/1 nanosecond is 1 gigahertz. You could say that that very brief pulse with a 1 nanosecond rise time is simultaneously testing all frequencies at once from DC to 1 gigahertz. And if any of those frequencies give you a bump, they give you a change in impedance, the TDR will reflect that to you as a bump on the screen, if you know what I mean. So the TDR is a very severe test. It tells you that on all the frequencies from 0 to 1 gig, in my example here, 1 gigahertz, if there's anything wrong with your transmission line, it'll appear as a bump on the screen. So that can give you a very severe, pessimistic result, so to speak, where you're afraid to think that at your favorite frequency, where that stub coming off to one side is exactly a quarter wavelength long into a short circuit, you would think it's not going to work because of your TDR test. And so you got to separate these two things and recognize what's really going on here. So at each of your frequencies where the stub is an odd number of quarter wavelength long, which represents the open circuit of the T connector, it'll work like a charm, even though the T connector will not show that to you. So the fact that you've seen, let me drop. The fact that you've seen results that you're not so happy with on a TDR doesn't necessarily mean that it's not going to work well for you. So Your TDR is a severe test on every one of the T-connectors. It's going to show you terrible results, no matter how long the stub is, whether it's short, open, or no matter what. Any stub at all on a TDR is going to give you a bump on the screen. That doesn't necessarily mean it's not going to work. And as I said before, in this system I'm recommending, where you've got this inexpensive antenna on the roof of the house, giving you 20 decibels of improvement as opposed to your rubber duck on a handy talkie inside the house. That 20 dB of improvement.
Hey, Doug.
Go ahead, Eric.
Stop transmitting for about 2 minutes. I'll tell you when to start.
Okay. I'll stand by for 2 minutes while Eric does his change. Okay, 2RAW standing by. Looking at his watch.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
I delaw to connect off.
And at a minute, Dick.
Roger, Dodger.
Okay, you're back in normal operation.
Okay, very fine, Eric. Looks like, the western input is now working. That's good. So, from what we heard, that TDR will give you a severe result, as you can tell, John. And you don't have to think that just because the TDR gave you a severe result that the stub on your T-connector is not going to work for your particular operation. You just have to properly interpret what the TDR is telling you, because it's testing all frequencies simultaneously from literally 0 to 1 gigahertz, and that makes it a severe test. Whereas at individual frequencies, your system may be working like a charm. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
10-2EO, Dick. You probably forgot me because of all the N2EO.
I'll copy, Dick. KC2WGB.
You sound good, John. Go right ahead. Being asked was on quarter wave, half wave, and things like this. And there's two different questions can be asked along these lines, and that is, there's an amazing number of hams out there who strongly believe that if the transmission line going from your transmitter to the antenna is not some magic length, odd number of quarter waves, even number of half waves, they got all kinds of theories, that they think there's some magic length of line between the transmitter and the antenna that's going to make the antenna work well, going to make the transmitter work well, and also going to make the directional power meter, your bird watt meter, work well, and your standing wave ratio meter work well. There's an amazing number of people who believe this magic length of transmission line. Absolutely, positively not true, with one slight exception. Let me drop. And that is, if you were foolish enough or quick and dirty enough that you just took your transmission line and connected it directly to, say, a balanced antenna like a dipole, where the center conductor went to the right side of the dipole and the shield of the transmission line went to the left side. When you do that, the fact that the dipole wants to act like a balanced device, by that I mean, if you're putting 10 volts into the dipole, it wants to adjust things such that the right side has plus 5 volts and the left side has minus 5 volts on the first half cycle. And the next half cycle, it reverses. The dipole wants to do that. It will do that. As such, even though you've got 10 volts between center conductor and shield of the cable, and you think you're putting 10 volts on the antenna, in reality, 5 volts of it is going to appear, in my example, coming back down the outside of the shield of the transmission line because you didn't use a balancing device. Therefore, the transmission line becomes part of your radiator. Your transmission line outer conductor and its length becomes part of the dipole, so to speak. In that particular case, as you change the length of the transmission line, you're changing the resonant frequency of the dipole because it's coupled to that outside shield of the transmission line. And therefore, the standing wave ratio measured in the shack will go up and down with length of transmission line because you're changing the length of the resonator, so to speak. Let me drop. So guys will make a measurement like that in the shack. They will see that change happen. They therefore come to the conclusion that there is a magic length of transmission line that will make the standing wave ratio disappear, or at least make it go to a peak or a valley. And they come up with all kinds of theories, depending on their particular length of transmission line when they do that experiment. The lack of a balance creates that crazy effect that gives you that result that allows you to start coming up with those theories. There's a zillion guys out there with that theory. The bottom line is that there is, if you've got a properly balanced, B-A-L-L-U-N, or the B-A-L-U-U-N, if you have the kind of a balancing device at the end of your transmission line going into your antenna so that your coax cable is not hot, there is no magic length of transmission line. Any old length will work like a charm. The only other case I can think of where there's a magic length of transmission line is that if you've got, say, for instance, a power divider, and the output cables of the two power dividers are going to two separate Yagis, so to speak, that are vertically stacked, and you want those two Yagis to behave in phase with each other, then you want those two lengths of transmission line coming out of the power divider to be equal in length. And even if they're equal in length, you can get into trouble, because some guys will make a vertically stacked pair of Yagis, and they do such a beautiful job of creating perfect symmetry. They'll set the bottom Yagi right side up, the top Yagi upside down, so that the coax cable coming out is the shortest distance on those links going back to the power divider. And because the upper Yagi antenna is mounted upside down, even with equal length of cable going to it, the signal coming out of the upper Yagi is 180 degrees out of phase compared to the lower Yagi. The bottom line of that is that now you get this very complicated vertical pattern, elevation pattern, where you've got a null on the horizon, and maybe 30 degrees above the horizon, you got a peak of signal, and 30 degrees below the horizon, you got a peak of signal. And so you'd be amazed how many guys have fallen into that trap, where they added a second Yagi, they expected to get a nearly 3 dB improvement, and all the signals they're listening to on the horizon are now 10 dB weaker because of this symmetry problem. But except for things like that, there is no magic length of transmission line, but there is with that T connector into a stub. Now that stub is intended to be a frequency selective device. In other words, maybe you've got a very strong taxi cab in your neighborhood that's giving you a lot of grief. And if you properly set the length of that stub coming out of the side of the T connector, you can create a beautiful notch at that frequency of that taxi cab and create very little insertion loss of the rest of the system and get rid of that one particular signal. So stubs into shorts and opens with magic lengths of stub can do some beautiful filtering characteristics, band pass or band stop. And that stub going over to your extra pigtail of coax cable going into your handy talkie while you're sitting in the living room, and you're really talking now through the antenna on the roof, can give a beautiful performance improvement. 20 decibels of improvement, 100-to-1 ratio of apparent power is within the realm of possibility. It's worth doing. As I said before, if you're a purist and don't want to just use a pure T-connector, disconnect the cable going further downrange so that now your T-connector is acting like a right-angle adapter, and now the system is nearly perfect. Let me do a quick test here. Okay, looks like 2585 is back in operation. KC2WGB, I made a guess as to what you were asking with magic lengths of cable. I hope I didn't go too far left of center, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Are you hearing me come through now, Dick? Is it all right?
Loud and clear, you sound beautiful.
Okay, I may have confused you a little bit with the question. The question was, the half-wave antenna is up on the chimney. He comes down with coax to a T to the second floor, and at the second floor, all he has is a loop of wire, a full wavelength. That's against the glass. He has the same thing on the first floor out of the T down there with another coil, which is a half-wave. And because when he did a full wave on the top floor and bottom floor, it did not work as well. So now he has a quarter wave on the first floor, a loop, half wave on the first floor, and a full wave loop on the second floor. If he sits in the easy chair, no connection directly, he's just inductively coupling and transmitting to the loop, and it works much better than when he had a full wave on both floors. He was just wondering if he should continue to fool around, like maybe make the bottom one a quarter wave. He wants to know if you could recommend any other way to improve it. This way he has no connection to the walkie-talkie, and he's in a very relaxed atmosphere. So, and that's and it seems to be working well for him. He just wanted to know if you could recommend something to improve it in some way.
Here's DPZ with a comment. I've got a whole lot of questions on what I've just heard. Over to you, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
Hey, hi, you and the whole TechNet. I tried to get in earlier when the fellow was talking about the hardline cable and the SWR problems. I just wanted to make a comment on that. I couldn't. That maybe he doesn't have 50-ohm hardline. He may have some 75-ohm or something else, depending on where he got it. And that's why he has all sorts of questions happening with that SWR.
Yeah, the hardline, though, he was using is Andrew Heliac's. And he had the choice of either the half-inch Andrew Heliax or 7/8-inch Andrew Heliax. And the chances of that being 70 ohms is fairly slim. Yes, if it was cable TV, hardline, all of that is 70 ohm, and that can create some confusion. But where he was using Andrew Heliax of a known model number, I kind of doubt that. A good suggestion, Hal, something to look out for, but might not be true in this case. Now, John, he's got a loop of wire. I'm not quite sure what we're saying here now. At first I thought you were talking about a loop of coax cable on the T-connector. That's not what you're saying. Is this an HF or a VHF antenna? It's a loop of wire, a wavelength long or a half wavelength long, and one of the loops of wire is in the second floor window and one's in the first floor window. And are these being fed simultaneously as a phased array or separate antennas? So to build a loop of wire to act on, let's say, 2 meters, if that's what it is, as a vertically polarized antenna on 2 meters, and a loop of wire is either half wave or one wavelength long, and to make sure the signal coming out of there has the right pattern and vertically polarized, that's a difficult way to go, because the loop of wire, if it's flat against the window, without a doubt is potentially a vertically polarized antenna if fed from the bottom.
but it's got a null in the pattern normal to the window. Parallel to the window, it has a peak in the pattern. So that may not be a desirable antenna for that application. There's a lot more going on here, John. Give me a little more words to describe the picture. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, he comes out of the T. Now, that RG8 cable, it's 2 meters, it's going up to the half-wave vertical antenna at the top. So from the T connector, he comes out of the T at the second floor with a loop of 16-gauge wire. It's one wavelength long. It's wound in a coil. It's against the window. And when he brings his HT over to that easy chair and sits there, the HT couples to that loop and goes out of the antenna. And he gets pretty good coverage. Also, down below on the first floor has the same thing, only that's half wave. He had tried another full wave down there, but when he had two full wave coils, it didn't work. He didn't get out far at all. But when he changed that lower coil over to a half wave, it worked much better. He was just wondering if he should keep changing that ratio. Do you think it'll improve? It seems to work well for him, and this way he has no cable going to his HT. So basically that's the setup he has.
Okay, in the very beginning you said when he comes out of the T connector, I presume there's now a cable draped through the house in various rooms with T connectors, places where he can tap into his handy-talkie.
No connection to the handy-talkie at all. It only comes out of the T, makes a coil that's pressed against the window. That's it. It doesn't go anywhere else.
Okay, comes out of the T. No handy-talkie. I'm hearing these words and I can't get a picture. Is this an antenna system where there is a length of transmission line strung throughout the house with T connectors where he's got various places to tap into it? That's question number one. But he's not using the T, he goes directly to the handy talkie or doesn't use the handy talkie. I'm confused. Make believe you've told me nothing, start at the beginning. Is there a transmission line? Where does it go? Are there T connectors? Are there not T connectors? Is the transmission line going to loop antennas? Is there more than one loop? Is it eventually going to a handy talkie? Is this on 2 meters? Over to you, John. KC2WGB. I'm awfully confused. Go easy with me. K2RAW.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Yes, it's all 2 meters. Now, he has a half-wave vertical dipole on the chimney. From there, RG8 wire comes down to a T connector at a second floor window. Out of that T connector, he has a PL259 that goes in there. That PL259 only has a full wave loop wound in a circle. That's pressed against that glass. That's it. Now the cable, the other side of the T, goes down to the first floor. That cable has another loop of wire, number 16 gauge, wound in a coil that's pressed against that window. The lower one is half wave. The upper coil is full wave. There is no connection to the HT. He's using the HT with his little rubber duck on it. He sits in an easy chair next to the window and couples to the loops. That's basically the setup. Need any more?
The real antenna, in this case, the antenna with the highest altitude that's going to give the most performance, is the vertical dipole, as you called it, on the chimney. That's the real antenna. If I understand correctly, he wants to now wirelessly connect to these loop antennas on second floor and first floor with the rubber duck of a handy talkie. He doesn't want to use a cable coming out of the handy talkie. Sometimes you got to put an adapter there in order to put a cable. And that cable going into the transmission line that goes to the antenna on the roof. And that's what I strongly recommend, because no matter how ideal that loop of wire is on the second floor or first floor, whether it's a half wave, one wave, or 40 waves, no matter how ideal that antenna is, you would be amazed the amount of loss you get in a very small number of feet of free space. If I had the most ideal antenna on the window of my house, and I've got my handy talkie, let me pick a number, 5 feet away, the drop in signal strength between the handy talkie and that ideal antenna pasted to the window is going to be 15 or 20 decibels of insertion loss. The way inverse square law works, the first few feet of a free space path out of a rubber duck gives you a ridiculous amount of loss in decibels. 10 or 20 dB happens real easy. And if that was a piece of coax cable coming out of the handy talkie, going to the transmission line, going to the roof, you'd get a fraction of a dB of loss instead of 10 or 20. So to do this wirelessly, where you can now have some freedom to walk around the room, on paper it sounds good, but that first few feet of air gives you a hell of a lot of loss, no matter how ideal that it...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
No matter how ideal that antenna is on the window. So, you can do some experiments with quarter wave, half wave, one wave, 40 waves, or whether loops, dipoles, monopoles, and so on. Ground plane antennas. You can do all of those experiments on the antenna against the window. But from the handy talkie into that antenna, which then goes to the transmission line to the roof, that air gap step is going to have a ridiculous number of dB of loss no matter what you do. Because your eye sees those two antennas a few feet apart, you assume the signal jumps from one to the other. That signal coming out of the rubber duck is transmitting in all directions in space. It's filling up a sphere with energy, and only a few degrees of that sphere includes the antenna against the window. That's one of the ways of explaining where the hell all the loss is coming from, conservation of energy. I'm not saying it won't work, but the fact you're getting a whole lot of loss with that technique, you can see somewhat where it's coming from, John. The pigtail cable, coax cable from the handy-talkie over to that transmission line going to the roof is going to make the signal 10 or 20 decibels stronger. That's 10 to 1 or 100 to 1 increase in apparent transmit power. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, I agree, Dick. Maybe if he wanted to play with something, he might try producing another coil and tune it up, connect that to the HT, and place that directly against the pane of glass, if that's what he wants to accomplish. He might have a little better results with that. I'm surprised he's doing as well as he is with it, and he seems to be fairly happy with it. But okay, so your recommendation is he should just go to direct connection to the antenna, because, I don't know, maybe they won't let him make any holes in the wall. Who knows? But all right, very good. I'll let it drop, and I'll pick up the next one.
Yeah, what he's doing is a good experiment, John, and so let's not discourage him. But you've got to know where the minefield is, if you know what I mean. And so whenever you've got an air gap between the rubber duck of your handy-talkie and any other antenna that's more than inches away, when it's feet away, you're going to get 10 and 20 dB of loss real fast, no matter what that other antenna is. And that's because of conservation of energy. The rubber duck is sending a signal to all places in space. If you're in the middle of a spherical room with that handy-talkie, and if the radio signal would create the electroluminescence of the panels in that spherical room, they would all be lighting up except for the ones directly collinear with the end of the rubber duck. And so it's sending signals everywhere. And it's you're starting off with a bit of a disadvantage. It'll work, but to know ahead of time why you're getting all this extra loss, now at least we know the mechanism of that. And so go to further comments on this if you want to, John, or to the next one. KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2IW in the TechNet.
No, I think he has enough information. He can keep playing if he wants to. It's interesting. And maybe he'll come back and let me know if he finds a way to improve it. But until that, no, we'll go on to the next one. Just let me let it drop. KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, here's one for you. This young amateur is studying wave propagations, and he understands about skin effect, but he wants to know the reason why that frequency keeps the energy on the surface in the circumferential area of the wire. Why exactly is that? That he's having trouble understanding. Even though he realize it's only penetrating at most a thousandth of an inch, and as the frequency goes up, it gets less. But he'd like to know if possible you could explain to him exactly what's happening there. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, this is not an easy one, but I'm going to make an attempt at it. Once you've sent a radio signal into space, for instance, that signal wants to see nothing but 377 ohms of apparent impedance. That's what free space is. And so when it encounters a 2x4, you're going to get some reflection because the 2x4 has got a dielectric constant of 4. So in other words, radio-wise, that 2x4 is 4 times more dense than free air, radio-wise. I'm not talking about the weight of material here. When it strikes a piece of wire, like the 80-meter dipole that you struck, 14-gauge wire, 132 feet long, and that's your 80-meter dipole in the air. That signal hits that wire, and of course, a significant amount of it gets coupled to the wire, goes down the transmission line, and makes your receiver respond. That signal hitting the wire sees the surface of the wire as an extremely low impedance device compared to air. And it wants to reflect off of it, so to speak, but because the wire is resonant and the signal couples to it, it's a little bit like what happens when you're pushing the child forward. Because of that resonance phenomena, a large percentage of your muscle power gets coupled into that swing, and the child starts swinging with larger and larger deflection. Radio-wise, that's happening on your dipole. Because the dipole is resonant, the signal that wants to reflect off the surface doesn't, and it gets coupled to the wire's resonance phenomena. But for the signal to penetrate into the wire, the surface of the wire...
Repeater, timeout.
The surface of the wire looks like a short circuit to that radio signal. And for it to penetrate into the wire, I guess you could say, no, I was going to say, it's a timing phenomenon. No, it's not. Not easy. Not easy to explain why it won't respond. There's a formula, a bunch of factors, and at the bottom of that formula is the frequency. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the depth of penetration is very small. At the frequencies we operate at, the depth of penetration of that radio signal in copper is around 1/10,000th of an inch. It doesn't go any deeper than that. And that's the reason why Litz wire works so well. Litz wire is a whole lot of small diameter wires insulated from each other in a bundle. Let me drop. And because you know that the depth of penetration is only 1/10,000th of an inch, if your bundle of wires all insulated from each other were each a 1/10,000th of an inch in diameter, then they would all be absorbing the signal, even though there's a great big bundle of them, if you know what I mean. And you wouldn't get the skin effect. That's why Litz wire works so well at higher frequencies, at HF and VHF frequencies, and sometimes used for winding high-performance coils. I'm suddenly realizing I don't have a nice, easy explanation for why it only goes down a 1/10,000th of an inch in copper and a little bit deeper than that in aluminum. It's a function of the conductivity of the materials. As you slowly slide between highly conductive materials like copper and aluminum and slowly slide toward non-conducting materials like plastic, the depth of penetration continuously gets bigger and bigger. And why does it only go down? As you can tell, I don't have a good explanation. I'm going to think about this and going to work on it during the week, John. Maybe I'll come back next week with a better explanation. Maybe if each one of us, if each one of us does an online search like Google, among other techniques, maybe somebody has got an easy explanation for why. It's an awful good question. It's something I've heard so often, I've accepted it, and it's one of the things that I didn't question, and I should have. I'm claiming to be a guy with curiosity, therefore I should have questioned this one. And up till now, I didn't. And I thought I had an impression as to what's going on. You just discovered that I don't. I ain't sure. KC2WGB. Let's see if anyone else on frequency can explain it to us. Drag your feet a little bit, John, in case somebody has got some smarts on this one. K2RIW and TechNet. John with a little delay.
VDH with a comment.
Mr. VDH, please clear this up for us. And I should know you. Start with your name, sir.
Yeah, fine business, Dick. Yeah, it's WA2VDH. Name is John. I remember the formula square root of 2 over omega sigma mu. So it depends on the permeability of the material as well as the conductivity and frequency. I know mu, the permeability is involved in it. Go ahead.
Good information, John. And because copper and aluminum has essentially no permeability. Permeability really means magnetic response. A material with high permeability means that a magnetic field will flow through the material with great ease. And magnetic field doesn't flow through copper and aluminum any different than air, so to speak. So that helps. But still, do you have a gut feel, John, as to why, in case of copper, at say, for instance, 7, and copper at 7 gigahertz, why in the world does that signal only go down 1/10,000th of an inch in copper at 7 megahertz? Got a gut feel for why that happens, John? WA2VDH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks.
Well, yeah, I would think, Dick, that as the increased permittivity tends to concentrate the magnetic field, that concentrated magnetic field is going to, by Lenz's law, set up a current to oppose it and is going to try to restrict the current from penetrating deeper into it. The same Lenz's law effect that gives you the back force of the generator. And the higher that the mu, the more the magnetic field is concentrated, and that would tend to oppose current from penetrating.
Well, maybe things are getting a little bit complicated because we're trying to think of a sheet of a copper, a round piece of wire. I think the phenomena we're looking for is more easily explained on a flat sheet of copper. A flat sheet of copper does make a pretty darn good RF shield. And the RF energy, when it encounters that flat sheet of copper, the RF energy only goes down 1/10,000th of an inch. The back EMF, so to speak, of Lenz's law, that's part of the explanation. But still, what makes it stop at 1/10,000th of an inch? Why does it go any deeper than that? You got a feeling for that one, John? W2VDH, K2RIW.
Well, I think it drops off exponentially. That 1/10,000th of an inch is like, I guess the equivalent of like 5 time constants. That's just falling off like exponentially. After that skin depth difference, we pretty much say that it's negligible beyond that, but I'm pretty sure it falls off exponentially the depth of penetration. Go ahead.
I think you're absolutely right, John. It is an exponential decay. Mathematically, the skin depth is defined as where the signal flowing into the conductor is 1 over E in magnitude. E is the natural logarithm, 2.718. So, When it falls off something like 67%, that's considered one skin depth. In the next skin depth, it falls off another 67%, and so on, 1 over E. So it's an exponential decay, 1 over E on each skin depth. So in theory, you could put microscopic instrumentation in there and measure the signal 1/10,000th of an inch down, 20,000th of an inch, I mean, 2/10,000th of an inch down, and so on. And you would find off this, you would reconfirm this 1 over E phenomenon. But still, they make a mental picture as to why it stops at that depth. Not easy for me. I think Wes thinks he's got a feeling on this. Let's see what Wes has got to say. N2XJN, K2RIW and TechNet. Why in the sheet of metal does it stop, so to speak, at 1/10,000th of an inch? Wes, you got it.
It depends from where you start from. If you go from the waves in conductive medium, then the Kerr equation for H has two source terms, and that would be the conductor. Go to the Maxwell equation and
trying to solve it with that. But for the skin effect, we try to see that. I found something. Okay. Here. I'm going to read it. Here we consider the classical skin effect that occurs for the alternating current in wires where the diameter of the wire is smaller than the skin depth, as we have defined in the above. Since the skin's above in depth, skin depth is in copper 0.85 of centimeter at, say, 60 hertz, we see that it affects can be felt even at power frequency for large conductors, such as those used in transmission lines. At radio frequencies, current is restricted to the surface of the conductors, and all of the copper in the middle is wasted. The analysis also contains some interesting mathematics, though, and whatsoever. So, but I would like you to eventually say a few words about the conduction current and deflection current. Enter XGN.
Yeah, Weston, bring up an interesting point. There are kinds of very large diameter transmission line coaxial cable, 3-inch, 6-inch, whatever diameter, where in some cases the center conductor is made out of a piece of relatively thin wall copper tubing, because copper has got a certain number of dollars per pound, it's expensive, and the copper that's more than a few thousandths of an inch thick at radio frequencies is not doing you any good. So make the center conductor out of copper tubing rather than solid copper, and that can save you some dollars and save you some weight. However, because the skin depth is a function of 1 over frequency square root, when you get down to rather low frequencies, like 60 hertz, depth of penetration at 60 hertz is so much deeper into the copper, because of this 1 over square root of frequency phenomenon, that when you try to shield magnetic fields coming out of a transformer, for instance, by putting a copper box around the transformer, you'll be amazed how poorly that works. I've been down that road. Let me drop. Good common sense would lead you to believe if you build a six-sided copper box with all the edges carefully shielded, carefully soldered together, overlapped maybe, and screwed together and whatever, you think you're going to shield the magnetic field coming out of a transformer. And as I said, you'll be amazed how poorly that works. You get some improvement, nowhere near as much as you expect, as opposed to using mu metal of that box, where now the magnetic field encounters the box, conducts through the box, and doesn't bother going to the outside world. The mu metal looks like a short circuit to the magnetic field, whereas the copper box does not. Because of this phenomenon of very, very large change in skin depth versus frequency, common sense would lead you to believe that once you've set the outer diameter and center conductor diameter of a coaxial cable, you think you have determined the impedance of that cable. Not at all. When you go down to low enough frequencies, that coax cable has a rather different characteristic impedance because of the skin depth changes. Also, the shielding characteristics of the coax cable is again very poor. You think you're getting some hum pickup. Let me drop. One of your critical wires of your voltage-controlled oscillator, of your spectrum analyzer, one of those wires that's controlling the frequency of your voltage-controlled oscillator, that wire is laced in such a way that it goes near a transformer, and the 60-cycle transformer is giving hum pickup to that wire. And then logically you say, well, I'll make it a shielded wire. You make it a piece of coaxial cable, and you'll assume that the hum pickup is going to go away. And you'd be very disappointed to find that you've attenuated a few dB, but that's not going to do it. You better use a different layout of that wire, because that magnetic field coming out of that transformer is very difficult to kill and very difficult to shield. By just putting a piece of coax cable there is not going to do it. There's a lot more to the story.
Some more. And I believe you could say a few words about it. If you look at the line, the field charge and electric field as well in the conductor, so you take the cross-section of the conductor, the electric field is propagated in all directions radially from the center. And then if you look at the field of line of current, it's sort of spiral. around the surface of the conductor. I could give you the question, but I believe it's just too much for it. But they came from the Gauss law. When the line charge along in space keeps the symmetry, means that can find field by the Gauss law in the radially shaped conductor. But it's not only limited to radially shaped conductor. In other words, is current is spiral to the surface, and the propagation of line of charges from the center radially all around. And to actually
quick input, Dick.
I'm about to pass it back to you, John. John, you and I pride ourselves in being able to come up with nice, simple mental diagrams that we verbally transmit to people over the TechNet in order to convey what's usually a complicated concept and bring it down to something that's understandable. We ain't doing that in this case. The classic ways that this is taught, classic ways by which this is taught, doesn't make it very clear, and we don't have a nice clear diagram on this one. The bottom line of all this is that if you take your ohmmeter where you're pouring DC current down a copper conductor and you measure the number of ohms per 1,000 feet, you come up with a very predictable number. Go to a much higher frequency and measure the same number of ohms of the same piece of copper conductor and you come up with a much higher number of ohms because you're not using the whole cross section because of the so-called skin effect. Therefore, there's ways you and I can measure this and confirm it, but what's really causing it? And the classic ways it's explained don't give you a nice, simple mental picture that you and I are conveying. We're going to have to go back to the books on this one and do a little further study, in my opinion. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet. I think he stumped us on this one, and I think we got to give him a reward, John. Go ahead.
Absolutely right, Dick. KC2WGB. He gets the reward. He's allowed to come back with another question, but not as difficult.
N128.
Alex, one way to get your attention. Well, somebody's still talking.
That's John. I'm hearing him on the input right now.
That he didn't show up last week. So back to you, Dick. KC2WGB. Finish with the mailbag.
Yeah, I've got to come over here to, I presume you're still working on the link. Is that part of what's going on, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
I'm finished now. But I wanted to get your attention. But a number of passes went by, and nobody stopped long enough for you to get in edgewise.
We're all ears, Eric, and maybe you've got a much better explanation. Fire away.
No, I haven't been listening to what's been going on. I just wanted to get my final thing done here, which is now done. And by the way, you want to know what actually happened to the dope defense?
Because I've got curiosity, because you had a failure of the link, and I know that Lou made an attempt to find out.
Seems like sometime this afternoon, somebody was in desperate need of a piece of end-to-end cable that was maybe 3.5 feet with a endel on the end of it. They decided they were going to take it. I mean, it's our fault that we didn't have padlocks on the cabinet, but if it ain't connected to an antenna, it don't do much good, and the amplifier gets very hot.
Wow, wow. So what you're telling me is somebody needed a jumper, opened up that cabinet, said, oh, here's one. Yeah, both ends are connected, but we'll just unscrew either end. Out of curiosity, were those type N connectors that got unscrewed, and now the person has the jumper? By the way, can you walk around the room and find that jumper, Eric? That would be kind of fun. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, the room is quite, it's not that big. Yeah, that was the first thing I did. I took a look around. I looked to see if there was some new stuff put in. And, most of the cabinets are locked. So you would think, you're in a shared environment. You want to steal from someone else's. not a lot of fun.
Is there a way of putting a lock on that cabinet, Eric? It looks like you might have to do that so that you don't supply spare parts for somebody else who's in a